but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Well, I joked for the last couple of weeks. Pivotal game one, pivotal game two, pivotal game three. They all count as one. And yet we talk about these games in a series as if they are more valuable. One more valuable than the other. For the Seattle Mariners, who have played 162 regular season games, five games in the American League Divisional Series, and now six games in the American League Championship Series, the 174th game of their season is a winner-take-all pivotal game. You either go home or you advance to the World Series to play the Dodgers. The Seattle Mariners fans, who are in many ways not unlike Blazer fans who suffered for years and have come to expect their team, their franchise, to blow it, to lose a lead, to blow a lead. What's going to go wrong? Those Mariners fans, how you feeling? I want to hear from you. 503-417-7575 is the phone number. Mariners failed to close it out in Game 6. They get a Game 7. What's the key tonight? John Smoltz talking about it. Listen to Smoltzy.
Yeah, I know the skin seems like a simple statement, but when I look at the series and I see the star power on both teams, you can look directly to the wins correlated to the stars. And it does come down to that. Now, you know, fair or not, Julio Rodriguez has been moved up to the number one spot because they've had to change their lineup. And I just look for the first two hitters to make the impact tonight.
Those hitters to make the impact tonight. We will also deal with the Toronto Blue Jays. It's a Game 7 for them as well. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. talking about what the stakes are.
The Blue Jays are going to play Game 7. Are you ready?
I born ready, and I want it all for this city.
There it is. Born ready. Are you ready? Mariners fans want to hear from you. What does it mean to you? What do you expect? We're going to talk a lot about college football. The Ducks coming off a big win, and it is a big win because they all count big. At Rutgers, thought Oregon bounced back nicely in winning on the road, did what they should do to a Rutgers team that had struggled on the defensive side of the ball. And Oregon State, at long last, 1-7 beats the hell out of 0-8. My daughter, who graduated from Oregon State last year, said to me, 1-7, Dad. I said, 1-0 this week. That was my response to her. Oregon State got a win, has now a quarterback controversy or quarterback clarity. Jamari Johnson comes in, runs wild, does well. This Malik Murphy experiment does not look like it's working. I have thoughts on that. We'll talk about it on today's show as well. Stephen Vaughn, you're in the hot seat. Where do we start? Mariners, of course. How are you feeling for this Game 7 for Mariners fans?
I mean, you have to be a little nervous, right? I felt like Game 6 was where you're going to get them. You're going against Tracy Yesevich, the rookie for the Blue Jays. He pitched like 5-plus scoreless innings. That was one of the worst 5-plus scoreless innings I've ever seen in a playoff baseball game. He had the bases loaded twice, back-to-back inning-ending double plays with the bases loaded for the Mariners. He just got snuck out of jams there. I felt like last night was the opportunity for the Mariners. Now, of course, you wipe that away. It's, you know, slate's wiped clean. Game 7, anything can happen. But I feel like if I'm a Mariner fan, I'm on edge, and I'm feeling a little nervous about this one because it felt like last night, John, was their opportunity with Logan Gilbert. He struggles again. I don't know, man. It's a toss-up for sure, but I would be feeling a little nervous right now if I'm the Seattle Mariners going into this Game 7.
Yeah, I mean, you can approach it that way. I saw, you know, Julio Rodriguez did an interview today, and he seemed really excited. You know, he's kind of got this joyful, kid-like sort of approach to the game, and he's just saying, gosh, this is what you live for. It's a Game 7. I think, you know, the sports psychologists will tell you that, you know, some guys will bear down and see this as an opportunity. Others will see and feel the pressure. And I kind of wonder what will happen to a Mariners team that, you know, in some cases, there are some players here who haven't been in this kind of situation before. And then you look over at the other side and you see some guys on that other side who have, and it's a mixed bag. I don't know what Dan Wilson will do as a manager in this situation. If you know, every decision's going to be big. Every decision's going to feel important, and I'm left kind of looking at this game and going, this is going to be sort of an interesting and pivotal moment in Seattle sports history.
The tough part for me, John, with the Mariners is they're so home run reliant. Like last night, all they had to do, you know, get a sack fly, bases loaded, get a run, and get some momentum. But they're so home run heavy, and that's how they score all their runs, basically. If you're not hitting the power, I mean, how are you going to score? And I feel like in a Game 7, you kind of got to play, you know, not small ball baseball, because I'm not a fan of small ball baseball, but you got to make the right choices. You got to get that extra, get the extra base, go first to third. You got to somehow manufacture a run or two to not let it get out of control. And I felt like last night the Mariners had their opportunities and then they just lost control. You know, then Vladdy hits a home run. It's like 4-0. He makes it 5-0. It just kind of gets out of the way. You can't lose pace. You have to somehow manufacture some runs. And I just don't think the Mariners, they haven't been good all season. They're one of the worst teams at, you know, sack flies, manufacturing runs like that. That just makes me worried in the Game 7 situation to say, look, we have to hit home runs or we're not going to win this game.
I am looking at the Mariners season. It's been so magical with Cal Raleigh and Julio Rodriguez and, Eugenio Suarez with the grand slam and the big game that, you know, got you the third win in the series and put you in the driver's seat a little bit. I feel like there have been different points of this postseason where the Mariners have been in this backs to the wall situation. Does it benefit them, Stephen, in your mind that they've already been in a winner take all game 5 in the ALDS?
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is when they won the Game 5, they went against Tarris Skubal, who is a better pitcher than Shane Bieber is. So, yeah, I mean, you got to be feeling good about that. I don't know that I feel like they're going to crumble. I saw a lot of tweets and a lot of things in social media last night that said, oh, the Mariners crumbled in Game 6. They really choked. I don't know that I agree with that, and I don't think that'll happen here in Game 7. The way that the Mariners are built in their roster, it just is not – they don't manufacture those runs, John. Like, they have a hard time getting that key single when they need it or, you know, making that extra base. It's all home run or nothing. And that worries me in the Game 7 because, these pitchers are going to be on fire and they're not just going to be, you know, throwing balls across the middle of the plate. You're going to have to make some type of play. So that's the worrisome part. I don't think they crumble at any point, though.
I am eager to see the pitching performances. I was watching late in the game last night, Game 6 last night. I was looking at the TV broadcast like everybody, of course, the fans in Toronto going nuts. And I thought John Smoltz made a really good observation on the broadcast where he said, you know, as a pitcher in a Game 7, you really want control of the energy inside the stadium. And he said, you know, the energy in Game 6, the fans were on their feet for the whole game. There were a lot of runs early for the Blue Jays. There was a lot of excitement and anticipation, of course, late in the game as they closed it out. But yeah, you can't let it get to that point. You need a good starting pitching performance from the Seattle Mariners. Do you have confidence they'll get the pitching performance tonight that they need? And then what will Dan Wilson do? Like, how patient will he be? Because you're watching, you know, a guy like Max Scherzer on the other side there, who, by the way, freaks me out with his eyes, like two different colored eyes. You know, like, you know, when he's doing the postgame interview, I have to look away. I feel like I'm gonna get hypnotized or something by looking at Scherzer. But he's in the dugout last night, late in the game, and he's locked in. And I have to think, Stephen, guy like Scherzer's thinking, hey, if you need me, and this gets into like a situation where you have to go 13 or 15 innings to decide the Game 7, you're gonna see these managers just say, all right, who do we got? You go to the end, you exhaust every option that you have, and you got a guy like Scherzer on the other side who nobody was really thinking about entering the series. He gave them a nice outing in, Game 5. that helped make this more of a series.
Yeah, I say this with the utmost respect to Max Scherzer, but that psychopath is ready to pitch this game. like that guy is going to say, yeah, hey, give me the ball if you need me. I can go out and give you as much as I can. I'm going to throw it as hard as I can and make them hit it. So, yeah, I think you're right on that. The eyeballs thing is pretty crazy. You know, he has a dog that has the same thing. He found a dog that has two different eye colors, and that's pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah, I'm eager for Mariners fans to, and Blazers fans, do you relate at all to this? 503-417-7575. Do you relate at all to this? I think there's some parallels between the baseball frustrations of the Seattle Mariners and the basketball frustrations of the Blazers. You both, at least the Blazers had that championship in 1977. And anybody who says, it's better to have loved and lost than not loved at all would understand it's better to have had a parade and know what a parade is like than to never have had a parade. But, you're in this situation, and I think Blazer fans, Stephen, you grew up a diehard Blazer fan. You've gone your whole life without seeing them win a championship. There's Mariners fans that are your age that have gone their entire lives without seeing a World Series appearance. This is big stuff to people in Seattle. I would love to hear from you at 503-417-7575. That's the phone number. And I think Blazer fans can probably relate to it. You've got a legendary broadcaster in Seattle, who called all those baseball games, and Dave Niehaus, and you've got a legendary broadcaster in Portland and Bill Shonley, and people may remember, there are big moments, and you can only replay them so often because Mariners fans and Blazers fans get chills just the same.
And John Wetland one more time set, and here comes the 2-2 pitch to Edgar Martinez down. The fastball swung on and hit the deep center field. Bernie Williams goes back, and it is get out the rye bread and the mustard this time, Grandma. It is a grand salami, and the Mariners lead it 10-6. I don't believe it.
There it is, Deet Niehaus and Bill Shonley. Come on, you can draw a comparison there, but I want to hear from Mariners fans. Let's go to David in Portland. David, help us understand this.
Easy to understand. Seattle, grunge, fighting for everything. They will fight up until the last inning to get this game 7, and then they're going to put the Dodgers on their heels. I don't want to hear it from anybody from L.A. My household is rocking. I left work early. I'm going home. This game is going home just like me in the bag. We're coming back to T-Mobile Park to play for the whole entire ship. I don't even care what anybody says.
You want the Dodgers and Shohei Ohtani. By the way, Ohtani, Steven, you see what Ohtani did? He's saying bring on the Dodgers. I'm going to let Ohtani cool off a little bit before I say bring on the Dodgers.
That's like back in the day when everyone chanted, we want Bama. It's like nobody really wanted Bama. Do you really want Shohei? 6 innings, 10 strikeouts, 3 homers in the same game? First time ever in the regular season or the postseason that someone did that. Incredible.
Yeah, I just kind of wonder in looking at that if you want the Dodgers or do you want a break and let the Dodgers sit? I'm glad it went 7. Let the Dodgers sit as much as possible. But what Ohtani did, it's being compared to Michael Jordan. It's, people are saying this is the greatest baseball player we've ever seen. Look at, he goes out and pitches and strikes a bunch of guys out. He hits 3 home runs. The Dodgers win. They're that good. I think it is a little bit reflective of the era we're in because no doubt you've got people who are saying, the Dodgers are building a roster that the rest of the league isn't okay with because they're circumventing the salary rules by deferring a bunch of Ohtani's compensation. I do expect the rest of the owners of Major League Baseball to look at that and be like, hey, you can't do that anymore. That deferral thing is such an advantage that the Dodgers have utilized. Their payroll is the second highest payroll in the league. And you got Mookie Betts coming out. Mookie Betts says that they're like the Chicago Bulls of the late 1980s, early 1990s. Do you buy that comparison that Ohtani's Jordan? And who is Mookie Betts? Is he Pippen or is he Bill Wennington? I am trying to figure that out.
Yeah, he's Tony Kukoc, Steve Kerr, one of those. No, he'd definitely be the Pippen, I would guess. But that's the problem is the Dodgers, they have like 7 Scottie Pippens on their team because they've just bought an entire team. You could argue Freddie Freeman and Teoscar Hernandez and Will Smith. They are all Scottie Pippens as well. So, yeah, I mean, Do I buy it in the sense that Shohei Ohtani is awesome and he's the best player in the league? Sure, I can buy that, and that you can compare him to Michael Jordan of maybe he's the best player of all time. I still would push back. It's still too early in his career to say he's the GOAT of Major League Baseball. You know, I did watch Barry Bonds. He was a guy that walked every single time because everyone was afraid of him. So I'm not ready to say that, but if you're saying best player in the league and you want to compare that to the Bulls, sure, Michael Jordan, I can see that. But I will say this, John, for the Mariners, I mean, or the Blue Jays too, but you know, we're talking Mariner fans here. If the Mariners get to the World Series, the rest of the nation is going to be pulling for the Mariners. I don't see how there's going to be a lot of neutral baseball fans that look at that because of how much the Dodgers spend and how it is seen as the Dodgers go out and buy all their players. I think there's going to be a lot of neutral Mariner fans that will, you know, latch on to this team because they do have a guy like Julio Rodriguez who is fun to watch and fun to root for. Cal Raleigh, obviously, the big dumper. I mean, he's fun to watch, too. I think this is, you know, if as that caller said, if they get by and they get to the Dodgers, I think it's going to be a lot of neutral Mariner fans. I think that's great for the Mariners if they do get to that actual World Series.
Yeah, I am eager to see this potential World Series. I think it's, you know, what do you think TV wants? Do they want Toronto? Do they want an East Coast, West Coast? They probably do. The television executives have to be sitting back at Fox and going, we need the eastern part of the United States not to be shut out in the same way college football's BCS and two-team playoff shut out the western part of the United States for years. I kind of think that the East Coast might go to sleep watching the Dodgers and Mariners play. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they'd rather have it be the Blue Jays than the Mariners have a West Coast World Series. I think us on the West Coast would rather have a West Coast World Series. That'd be pretty fun. But no, I think that also the fact that they're in Canada, they can kind of play up the, you know, U.S. versus Canada type of thing. I think the TV execs would definitely be rooting for the Blue Jays to advance to the World Series.
I am eager to see that. And, you know, I'm pulling for the Mariners. I'm pulling for the Pacific Northwest. I always will. Meanwhile, you've got college football. People downplaying Oregon's win against Rutgers. I want to say this, like, you're in an impossible position if you're Dan Lanning. You have, you know, you're just coming off this loss to Indiana. You need to go out and you need to have a solid performance, and they do. They go across the country. They go play at Rutgers. It's teed up for them, and they knock it out of the park. I mean, offensively, Oregon just had its way, in part because Rutgers is not very good. But I feel like the criticism, people now going, oh, well, they didn't play anybody. They didn't beat anybody. It doesn't change anything about the Indiana game. I think it absolutely does change something about the Indiana game because I wondered how Oregon would respond. It looked to me like Oregon got back to business. Now, I'm not saying that you have to appoint Oregon as a college football playoff semifinalist after watching them beat Rutgers. But I am saying I liked the response from Dan Lanning's team. And I think you're nitpicking if you say, eh, it doesn't mean anything, because I think everything means something. You know, how you do anything is how you do everything, as they say these days.
But isn't this what Dan Lanning does? Dan Lanning beats the teams he's supposed to beat by a lot. But then when there are close games against, you know, Indiana, who was only a touchdown or a little less than touchdown favorite, Washington in his first season, he's struggled in those games. So, like, I think that's where fans are coming from, is that, like, look, yeah, cool, you can beat Rutgers, a team you're supposed to beat by 20, you know, your 24-point favorite, you're going to crush that team. But when you face a good team, that's when they've, you know, been prone to struggle the last couple of seasons.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, you know, we've watched them at different points play very well early in the season and not play their great football late in the season. What comes to mind is them going to Wisconsin late last year. Didn't think that they were playing their best football. I really think that Oregon, I think in the end, we're going to look back, and I only know this anecdotally because we had Will Stein on the show a few weeks ago. And I picked up in that conversation I had with Will Stein, Oregon's play caller, that Oregon was trying to manage the number of snaps, the snap count on their players better than they did last season. Maybe they learned that from Ohio State, which played slower than ever last year, even though they had Chip Kelly playing, calling the plays. So I think they've learned that it is a grind. It is a 14, 15, 16 game schedule. It's a marathon. I'm not going to throw out this tin foil hat conspiracy theory, but I think down deep, there might have been a little bit of, okay, it's good to lose one. Maybe in the back, deep, deep back of Oregon's brain, as they played that Indiana game. I just kind of wonder if they were going, we don't want to be 13-0 and the one seed in the college football playoff. I have no evidence of this. I don't have anybody telling me that. This is just me kind of spitballing and looking at it and going, down deep when Oregon walked off the field after losing to Indiana, was there some part of Dan Lanning's heart that sang a little bit with the idea of, we're going to get to play the role of underdog in a potential playoff situation? He's going to have that vein popping out of his neck if they play Indiana again. He's going to talk about how they were disrespected and nobody believed in him. He's going to talk about how they got pushed around. And now they're in the position that Ohio State was in a year ago if they can do that. Now, it's dicey. You don't want to give away a win. I'm not saying that they threw a game because they didn't. But I am saying, is there a silver lining to them losing at home to Indiana? I think there absolutely is. Because I think if they play this right and they show up to play late in the season like Ohio State did a year ago, I think we're all going to look back and go, oh, that loss was great for them. Am I sounding crazy, Stephen?
You won't sound crazy if you're right. If Oregon advances to the, you know, the semifinals of the CFP, I think that's the narrative that's going to be played. I think you sound crazy because I don't think anybody wants to lose ever, and I don't think losses are good in any sense of the word. Like, we played a win game. Like, I don't think Dan Lanning's happy with any type of win, even in the back of his mind, because I don't think the rest had a lot to do with the Ohio State loss last season to the CFP. I don't think that really matters. So I think you're a little crazy by that way, but I do think if Oregon advances to the CFP semifinal, advances to the College Football Playoff final, that'll kind of be the talking point of, like, look, you know what, that Indiana loss, great loss to have during the season.
503-417-7575, the number if you want to weigh in. Coming up, we're going to talk with Olivia Cleary. She is the reporter at KEZI who was on the scene at Oregon State as the Beavers won their first game of the season on Saturday against Lafayette. You may have seen this on social media. It went viral. She's trying to do a live shot from the concourse at Research Stadium, and she's got a bunch of bozos and idiots yelling at the cameras coming forth. A few of those kids have apologized. Alcohol may have been involved. We're going to get a visit from Olivia Cleary coming up. She's going to talk about that. She will be joining us. Plus, I want your phone calls. 503-417-7575. You got the BFT statewide.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I'm on social media like everybody else, just about everybody else. And on Saturday, Stephen, I know you saw this too. This Oregon State game was interesting to me because I was looking to see, is Oregon State actually going to pull this thing out and win a football game for the first time in 329 days? And they did. The Beavers won the game. And then on social media, you, of course, see some nonsense going on, including fans that are on the concourse at Research Stadium as KEZI reporter Olivia Cleary is reporting from Corvallis. For people who don't know, TV reporters in stations like Eugene often operate as a one-man band or a one-person band. And you've got a tripod, you've got a camera, you've got lighting, you've got a microphone, and you're doing the equivalent of a live shot on your own without a photographer there. And here's how it sounded for Olivia Cleary on Saturday night.
The football is, you can definitely tell there is a new play caller in town. The offense is looking, 1 second, the offense is looking a lot more versatile. They're getting their tight end in there with more reps. Still seem really characteristic with the running game. I've definitely seen a lot more passes from Malik Murphy to Trent Walker. And I think even though the game is tied, the offense has looked entirely different. And we'll see how it goes through the second half of this game.
Is this weird? No, we're lost.
Stop.
22 years old, by the way.
22 years old and no doubt ingesting alcohol. Stephen, what'd you make of that? I was disappointed to see the fan behavior. It's not like the worst thing we've ever seen, but acting like an idiot while somebody else is trying to do their job is never fun.
Yeah, like not even funny in a little bit. Like that's the problem. It's like they're trying to be funny. It was not funny at all, and it was stupid 6-7 thing, which I can't stand anymore because my kids do it 24 hours a day.
Can you explain that to people who don't know what 6-7 is?
As far as I understand, John, it started from a basketball player. He was doing a meme, and it's from a song. They say 6-7 in it, and it's a meme, and he just did 6-7. He started like shaking his hands up and down. And they've asked him about it, what it means. He said, it doesn't mean anything. And so it actually means literally nothing. And people have taken it and just run with it as a meme that they do a lot on TikTok and stuff. And so anytime someone puts those numbers together, they just say 6-7. And it's really annoying.
Everybody in the middle school or middle schoolers coming home saying that. And, of course, they're on the concourse. But here to talk about it, Olivia Cleary. She is a reporter at KEZI, and she is joining us. Olivia, I got to give you some props. You had poise. You had composure. I don't know how you did it. I would have taken a swing at one of those guys with the microphone, but tell us what that was like for you.
Yeah, I mean, I've been seeing comments about where I set up. I set up on the concourse. You know, fan interaction is something that is valuable sometimes, so I wanted there to be some fans in the background just, you know, walking around doing whatever. I wasn't really expecting them to come up that close. It was fun at the beginning, and then it was like the couple guys hung around, and I was just like, what is going on right now?
As you're doing that, give us an idea of how that feels, because you can't really turn and be like, hey, guys, I'm trying to do a live shot, because you're actually in the middle of your live broadcast. And so you're trying to stay composed. Did you have a sense of what was going on behind you, or did you only realize it later?
I mean, I feel like it's pretty hard not to hear the 6-7 going on behind you.
Yeah.
But honestly, in those moments when I'm working or whenever I'm doing anything, I feel like I just have a very one-track mind. So I was like, okay, let me listen to Brett, who was in the studio talking, and let me hear what he's asking me and give the best answer I can. I mean, I grew up with a little brother, so I'm kind of used to people trying to distract me sometimes. So, but I guess it paid off.
Olivia Cleary, our guest, KEZI. You know, you get through it. Did you expect that this would be a viral moment and that, you know, it would be all over social media? Or at what point do you realize that people would be talking about it?
Oh, I didn't expect it at all. Brett Taylor, our sports director, didn't expect it. He originally tweeted just saying, you know, it's unacceptable. Let local reporters do their jobs, and ended up posting the clip. And it was just a shot from our live, so it wasn't the actual broadcast. And you can really hear everybody in that one, but we didn't expect it to blow up or anything like that. Just kind of bring awareness to what reporters go through. But everyone at my work's been really great about it. Brett's been great. My other bosses and coworkers, Matt Templeman, Mike Boring, Greg Hasser, they've all been super supportive about it and have been, just amazing and making sure I'm safe and everything like that.
Oregon State issued a statement saying, you know, look, this isn't what we expect. They said they would look into it, investigate it. Sounds to me like some of those guys have come out and apologized. Did you hear from some of those guys in the video?
Yeah, I did. I heard from the guy that was saying 6-7 and the one that was in the back saying, help me. They both reached out to me, which I really respected. They did it just individually. It wasn't like they posted something publicly. And it felt really sincere. It was good to hear from them. They were super genuine, took full accountability, which is always great. And yeah, there's no hard feelings there.
Look, what do you learn from this? Because, you know, there's some people who are saying, you know, this is, you know, she's being targeted because she's a woman. I don't hear you saying that. I think you're saying you got maybe targeted because you were a TV news reporter doing a broadcast.
Exactly. Like, you took the words out of my mouth. I don't feel like I was targeted because I was a woman. I mean, being a woman in sports definitely comes with its challenges, and I'm very aware of that. But I just hope conversations like this help move things forward in a positive way. And again, my supervisors and coworkers here lifted me up through this. A lot of them have similar stories sometimes. Just live TV is unpredictable, so you kind of have to be ready for everything. And they did a good job preparing me when I first started about how to go live, how to respond in those situations. And so I'm just very appreciative of them for that.
What do you do moving forward? Does it change the location you do it? Do you ask for a security guard when you go to do a live shot? You know, so this is all teachable stuff, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, you've had these discussions with your news director, but how do you handle this moving forward?
Yeah, well, specifically for Oregon State, they've also been super amazing. They reached out to me and they said if I ever am doing a live shot again there, that'll let their security team know. And one of them will kind of stand with me and make sure nothing gets too crazy. So that's one thing I can do. Definitely probably a location sometimes further away from where they were serving alcohol. I wasn't really aware that that was like the hot spot where the students were coming over, getting their drinks, and then maybe going back. I just thought it was a good spot on the concourse that doesn't show the field, because when the game is going on, which it was like the end of the second quarter, we can't show the field. So it's like you got to kind of get creative with where your live shots are. So places on the concourse is really probably the best and only option, because again, you don't want to have a boring blank wall behind you. Usually you want to see kind of a little bit of the environment and what's going on.
Yeah, you got some environment in that live shot. I will give
I will give you that.
I appreciate the way you're handling it. You know, I've known you a long time. It's cool to see you blossoming as a reporter. And certainly I think the way that you've handled this, the poise you've had, the grace you've had with it is good. I don't think this is going to be a major news story. And in some weird way, I think it gives, you know, those kids in the background chance to have a teachable moment. So there you go. I think mission accomplished. Some good came out of it. But I got to admit, Olivia, when I saw it, I just shook my head because I was like, you know, you've been in that situation. I've not been in that situation during a live broadcast, but I have been doing a radio show and people will come up to me and start yelling or want to argue, you know, and I commend what you did there because I don't think I would have handled it that well.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Olivia Cleary, there she is. You can find her at KEZI. Thanks, Olivia. Thanks for joining us also on Twitter as well. Steven, I'm glad the guys apologized. I don't think anybody needs to be arrested. I don't think anybody needs to be banned from the stadium. But I do like that Oregon State at least came out and said, we are investigating this. They're basically saying we don't condone this. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, no one needs to be expelled. No one needs to be arrested. Nothing like that. Because, you know, at the end of the day, they were trying to be funny. They were trying to become, you know, viral themselves, I think. And that's not illegal. Like, they didn't do anything illegal. But it is not a good look for them. It is not a good look for the school. It's not a good look for the program in general, especially when Oregon State's 0-7. Like, you want positivity coming out of your football program, and that is not going to help. So I'm with you. Like, I'm glad that they reached out to Olivia and they did it in a way where it wasn't all over social media. Like she said, they reached out individually to her. I think that's great. Don't make a whole big scene of it where you write in your little notes and write an apology letter. I love that part. So, you know, I think you're right. I think it's a teachable moment. I think these kids probably learned and like looked at themselves in the mirror and thought, wow, we look horrible. We have no fans in our corner and we need to do something about it. So I think ultimately, like you said, it's going to turn out good. It's going to be a positive. But, man, I was with you, man. When I saw it on Saturday, I thought, what in the world are people doing? Like, why do we think this is okay to just go up and
just go to somebody's job
and bother
and
them.
Start yelling at them? Try that. Try going into anybody's job and doing that.
Do you think there was a part of it because she is a woman that they felt it's okay, where if it was a man, they may not have done it? Because that did cross my mind a little bit. Like,
I think first of all, they see a TV camera and lights on. And I've seen this before. Everybody's seen this. There's a TV reporter doing a live shot on a street corner. People drive by and honk their horn. So they hang their head out the window and yell something. And I don't know what it is about a camera that makes people want to act like they're 12 years old, but sometimes it happens. So I think first and foremost, it was about that. I can't ignore, though, the idea that she's there alone. She's got to be like 22, 23 years old. She's right out of college at Oregon. And, you know, this is her first big job. She's at KZI. And I've known Olivia since she was, you know, like 10 or 12 years old. And I've known her because my daughter played volleyball. Olivia played volleyball. And you know, people may not know this, but Olivia Cleary is the daughter of, you know, Valerie Johnson, who used to be Valerie Cleary, who was the athletic director at Portland State. So this is, you know, somebody people in our region should know and respect and be proud of the fact that she grew up here and she's part of the fabric of the community here and she's got ties here and she's trying to make a job here and get some traction. But you also can't deny that TV stations these days with budget cuts, You know, they don't have a camera person there in Eugene to be with her on the scene. And in some cases, I've seen it happen in Portland where there's not a camera person there to kind of run interference. And I think it's a different dynamic if there's a 6'2", 240-pound camera guy standing with Olivia on the concourse who can kind of run interference. I'm not saying he's a bouncer, but she's defenseless when she's doing the live shot. Like, she can't stop and say, hey, guys, I'm trying to do a live shot. You know, they just see a camera and they think, oh, this is my 15 minutes.
That would have made it way worse had she said something.
Yes. She handled it right. I don't think I would have. She handled it right.
I know I wouldn't have.
I think, but I also don't want to make it a gender thing because I don't think she is. And so I don't think she was necessarily targeted, but I do think the guys, you know, it's not like they did anything dangerous.
No.
It's not like, you know, they were, you know, I don't think she felt threatened physically. I don't think she felt, you know, feared for her safety or anything like that. But I do think, like, you know, it being a 23-year-old woman who's trying to do the live shot and having a bunch of 23-year-old guys jump around in the background, I felt for 23-year-old women across the country when I saw those guys in the background. I was like, I worry about this generation of young men. Like, and where was the guy? You know, there was one guy in the shot that I thought was going to step up, Stephen, and turn to the other guys and go, hey, knock it off. Where was that guy? That's the thing that disappointed me the most as a man, if you want to make it about gender, was I would have hoped that if I had a son in that situation and a bunch of people were acting like idiots, I would have expected my kid to be the one who would go, hey, guys, let's knock it off. She's trying to do her job. Like, everybody knock it off.
Yeah. You know? And that's the thing is, you know, she's not making it about gender, and I think that's awesome. But there is always that uphill battle for any type of woman in sports. Like, whether you're a coach, athlete, reporter, whatever it is, there's always an uphill battle. So I don't know. I can't put it. It's not definitely 100% because the reason why, I think that's partially a reason why that they felt more comfortable going up and interrupting her. But like you said, lack of respect. That's all it was. It was such a lack of respect for anybody in that situation to do that to. So shout out to Olivia, the way she handled it, man. She killed it in that one.
Well, I thought she did well. I thought she helped herself. I want phone calls. Duck fans, Beaver fans, what did you make of the weekend? Oregon State fans, how are you feeling about the quarterback situation? Is it a controversy or is it clarity? And Oregon fans, how much credit do you give Oregon for playing well against a Rutgers team that isn't going anywhere meaningful? 503-417-7575. Phone lines are open now.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Oregon State has announced the hiring committee for the next football coach. It includes Brandon Cooks, former player, Mike Riley, former coach. It includes Nikki Neuberger, former standout volleyball player, who is now the vice president in charge of branding for Lululemon. It includes a member of the Reeser family. It includes the former head of the OSU Foundation, Joth Ricci, the chairman of Burgerville on the committee as well. No current coaches, no Scott Ruick, no Pat Casey, no Mitch Canham. I find that to be a misfire by Scott Barnes. But I do think bringing some people into the fold like Brandon Cooks and some others, Brandon Cooks has been outspoken that he's not on board with a lot of what Scott Barnes is doing. Bringing some people into the fold that aren't exactly Barnes fans is interesting. I was told that is AD 101. You bring your enemies closer and your friends close, if you want to say it backwards. We'll talk more about that in the 4 o'clock hour. I want to know what you make of Oregon's win over Rutgers, Oregon State's win over Lafayette, 2-0, Beavers and Ducks. First time in more than a year that's happened. Both won on the same weekend. Let's go to the phone lines. 503-417-7575. We'll start with Matt, who's in Fairview. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. So I just wanted to weigh in on the Ducks. I definitely give them credit. And I think that they actually improved along their offensive line. Even looking back to the Montana State game, even the Northwestern game, they were getting teams were getting penetration on Oregon. There was even I remember the Montana State game, a running back who basically got trucked by a linebacker to give Dante Moore about 4 seconds to make a play downfield. So teams have been getting penetration, and I saw massive improvement on that on Saturday, as well as they were just kind of having some fun, some trick plays and some different things like that. I think getting some confidence back for Dante Moore was huge. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's really good to come back and, you know, I'm honestly really put a big, you know, beating on a Rutgers team. Yeah, I know they're not very good, but at the same time, like, you're supposed to get a win like that after you do that, if you want to cement yourself as one of the top teams in the nation.
Yeah, and look, you have to come back in that way. And I like what you said, you know, they look like they're having fun again in this game. Ultimately, Oregon's going to be judged, though, on the games against who? Indiana and Ohio State, probably, within their own conference. And, you know, if they play in the Big Ten championship game or not. And that's where people will judge Oregon on. Do they get to the playoff? How do they perform when they get to the playoff? It's how people judged them last year. It's how they'll be judged this year. Let's go to Cam and Eugene, who's listening on that powerhouse station, Fox Sports Eugene. Cam, what's up?
Hey, John, real quick with Oregon State, I heard you in the last segment refer to those kids as young men. Those are not young men. Those are overgrown kids in college. The way they acted was silly. They did not represent their school well, and their school should figure out who those people are and let them know not to do that thing again. It was embarrassing, especially on what should have been a happy night for Oregon State.
Yeah.
For the Ducks, boy, what a difference a week makes. Or I could say I told you so, or not you, because you weren't the people I was telling. I was just saying it to the universe. But we came out in a pistol set, and we started running the ball vertically. And next thing you know, things start opening up. Against Indiana, we tried to supplement the run game with a lot of wide receiver screens, and it didn't open things up the way I thought running the ball would. And next thing you know, the defense is concerned about the run coming up in the middle. The tight end is free in the seam, catching big touchdown plays. And that pitch to Noah Whittington, I don't think, you know, if they're not worried about the run coming up the middle, that pitch doesn't work because you're not distracting them the way that you ought to be and forcing them to defend the entire field. And it was great, and I'm glad for the Ducks. I think we can keep the tinfoil hats off. I don't think it has anything to do with them wanting to lose a game, especially not with game day in town. But, you know, this will work against the Indianas of the world. We need to remember this as we go through the season. And it's a shame we didn't do it a week ago. But going forward, I want to see more of that game plan. Come out, run the ball, you know, hit the tight end in the seam. It's nice to see more than one deep threat for Oregon. It's been DeCorian Moore all year. Now it's DeCorian Moore. And, you know, a couple of the tight ends got in on the action. Sadiq caught two touchdowns. And schematically, that's just so much better than what I saw against Indiana on offense.
Appreciate the phone call and the input. Let's go to Vanita. Jim is in Vanita. Welcome to the conversation, Jim.
Hey, John, how's it going today? Great. Thanks for taking my call.
I bet
the Ducks played so much better, the offensive line especially. And like the previous caller mentioned, we didn't see eight wide receiver screens or inside screens. We saw good old-fashioned blocking and running the ball straight up the middle, and that was just so great to see us be successful. I also thought Dante Moore saw the field much better this weekend.
Yes.
He saw open receivers. But more importantly, John, it's really a moral and ethical victory because, as you know, Greg Schiano, the coach of Rutgers, he was on staff at Penn State when Sandusky was there. And during the trial of Sandusky, people gave sworn testimonies that Schiano knew what was going on but didn't say anything and kept his mouth shut. So it was great to see him just get steamrolled in the first half and lose big time at home because of how I feel about what he didn't say or didn't do when he was on staff at Penn State.
Yeah, I can remember when Mark Helfrich was fired at Oregon. Schiano, his name came up during that time, and there were a lot of people who were not excited about him even being mentioned as a possible candidate at Oregon. Roy in Portland. Roy, welcome back.
Hey, how are you doing, John? Hey, John, just a quick thing on that Schiano. It was one person's fault, and that was Joe Paterno's. He was told what that dude was doing, and Joe Paterno did not do anything about it. Nothing goes through nothing without Joe Paterno. So everybody want to blame Schiano and all the other people. It was one person's fault that could have fired him, that had that man on his staff for decades. That was Joe Paterno.
Yeah.
So on on another note, John, this may hurt some people's feelings there, but Oregon hasn't really beaten anybody this year, man. Mm-mm. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the schedule, John. I'm sorry. I'm just calling it how it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that Penn State game was going to be something, but we turned out that Penn State is not good. And, you know, they don't play Ohio State. And Indiana, you know, I'm not sold on Indiana either. I don't think Indiana's the number two. I think they're well coached, but I don't think they're the number two team in the country. I think if they get out of conference, they'll get beat. I think the Big Ten is bad this year. You got a bunch of bad teams, and then you got a bunch of mediocre teams, and then you got maybe one elite team, and well, you got two undefeated teams. I don't know how elite Indiana is. You got Ohio State, so I don't know where Oregon will end up, John, because that Washington game to me is looking tricky. Looking tricky on the road. Yeah. That USC game is looking tricky.
Yep.
So I mean, I don't know. And don't sleep on to Iowa. Don't sleep on to Iowa.
Yeah, you gotta go to Iowa in that one. Good point.
That's not gonna be a walk in the park. I mean, they never been to Iowa. That's a hard place to play. That's a hard place to win. They got a well coached team, and they almost beat Indiana.
Yeah, there you go.
They play Indiana closer than Oregon did.
Well, we're going to find out, Roy. We're going to find out. I want more phone calls. 503-417-7575. Do you agree with Roy? Has Oregon not played anyone? Is that Oregon's fault? We'll see. Plus, later in the show, in the 4 o'clock hour, we're going to go to Jason Puckett in Seattle, take the temperature in front of the Mariners Game 7.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
We'll take phone calls. 503-417-7575. What do you make of Oregon's win over Rutgers? Oregon State's win over Lafayette? I have some of the financials on what Oregon State is paying Lafayette to come play that game. They're paying them $500,000.
Were you worried for another loss at halftime?
Well, I wasn't worried because I'm not like fan guy.
Right. But were you thinking this is another L?
You and John Wilner texted me within 30 seconds of each other. Basically saying, hey, man, this isn't really happening to Oregon State, is it?
I thought they were losing. I thought they were lost. It was a great bounce back second half, but, man, that first half, they looked like two evenly matched teams.
Who would you play at quarterback?
Jabari Johnson.
Do you think the Malik Murphy thing is over?
I do. His body language was not very good on the sideline. There's a picture of him still from the TV broadcast.
Yeah.
Jabari brings some energy. He brings some juice. The fact that he came out and said, look, it was after the Wake Forest loss. He said, guys have already quit. Guys quit after the Cal game.
You think he was talking about Malik Murphy?
Yes, and others as well. But Jabari Johnson has showed he cares about this team and cares about just playing football. So he brings juice that I don't think anyone else does. So, yeah, I'd let Johnson give it to go. And it's kind of like one of those things when you're tanking in the NBA, you got to see what you got. Maybe Jabari Johnson's your guy next year. Maybe he's not, but you need to see what you have in him.
I am eager to see what happens. Rob Akey, the interim coach after the game, said, you know, basically, you know, how proud he was of his guys. His post game was inspired talk.
Well, how y'all doing? Well, I tell you what, it's I'm happy. I'm happy as can be to see these guys smile, and they were able to, and it was cool, and I was glad to see the way that they responded, because they got, we were in a battle at the beginning of the game, and it was frustrating for them, and you could see things in their eyes, and the way they came out and battled their tails off and fought to finish their jobs and found out that they could have the success that they were capable of and started making plays, and then we talked about it in here a few days ago. You get a little spark lit, and if you can get some gasoline on that thing, you can get make some things roll. And so I'm just happy for those guys. They're smiling and they're happy and they're feeling good. They got to play the game that they love and smiled and finished it the way they wanted to. So that's the biggest thing that I'm excited about.
There it is. He's excited. He's energized. He's doing what an interim coach should do. I was surprised they were down 13-10 at halftime. And then they go on to win the game. Jabari Johnson running the football. Malik Murphy not effective. And then Johnson was just great. Now, I don't think Jabari is good enough that you just hand him the job and say, it's your team now. You don't do that. I still think you try to play Malik Murphy. Because I think you need his arm in the game at times, you know, depending on what the defense is going to do. Because remember what teams did a year ago when Jabari Johnson was in the game, Stephen? They said, this guy can't throw the ball down the field. They cover everything underneath and force him to try to throw the ball over the top, and he can't do it. But he's a better runner, and he's a more inspired player. And you know what? I'm sick of seeing Malik Murphy throw off his back foot.
Yeah, and even on Saturday, Johnson threw a bad interception, tried to go deep in the end zone, threw in a double coverage, intercepted by Lafayette. They saw it right away, and I'm with you. He was a four-star coming out of high school. Like, he has some talent. He has some athleticism. But I think right now, when you're Oregon State, you got Rob Akey out there. He's bringing the juice. Jabari Johnson's going to bring some energy. I think that's all you kind of want out of the rest of the Oregon State season. Get the kids excited. Get the team excited about something. And I think Jabari does that. So for me, like, you don't necessarily want to give him the keys right away, but you may have to because he just brings more energy than Malik Murphy's done all season long.
I am eager to go to the phone lines. Let's go there. 503-417-7575. Mike, welcome to the show. What's up, Mike?
Say, John, man, I want to put everything in perspective. You know, Dan Lanning in his post-game interview said something that was quite telling. He said that this time around they had a better game plan, which tells me that when it came to Indiana, he couldn't intellectually construct a game plan to beat that team, because I think Indiana is very good. But let me give you a little background on Rucker. The reason the Ducks beat Rucker was not so much on talent, but was based on worldview. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Rucker is a colonial college. It is one of the very few colleges that was established before the Civil War. And if it wasn't a public school, it would be with the Ivy League schools. Now, what I mean by worldview is that the Rucker players are not trying to go to the NFL like the Oregon Duck players and some of the other football players. The Rucker players are going to be running corporations. They're going to probably be running the NCAA and all of these in the government. These players are not dependent on NIL. They're not trying to go to the NFL. Matter of fact, right now, there's only 7 Ivy League players in the NFL out of a total of over 1,600 players. That means that these players are not concerned about being a Heisman Trophy candidate. Mm. So that's why Oregon was able to beat Rucker, folks, because Rutgers are not trying to be NFL players. That means that Dan Lanning didn't have to really coach to beat this team. Talk to you later, John.
Right. Well, you've got Isaiah Pacheco with the Chiefs, came from Rutgers. Bo Melton of the Packers was at Rutgers. Sebastian Joseph Day of the Titans, Rutgers. I think Ray Rice went to Rutgers. So did Jason McCourty, Muhammad Sanu. Trying to think who else. I think the Bears have a running back who's there. I'm trying to think who else. There are a number of players played at Rutgers. But I think what Steven's saying is Rutgers isn't good at football. They're not a great football team with a bunch of history. Does that mean Dan Lanning didn't have to come up with a plan? The criticism of Dan Lanning, you can criticize him for the plan against Indiana. I think Indiana had a better plan. You can criticize him for losing the games at Washington. I think you can criticize Dan Lanning for a number of things, you know, that decisions he's made in critical fourth down situations. I think he's got a little bit of a gambler to him. He's a little bit of a gambler. But I really hesitate when, you know, they bring a lamb to you and you do what you should do to a lamb and you're a lion. I hesitate to blame the lion for that. Well, you know, if you have a, you know, Pat Hill, the old football coach at Fresno State, used to have a piranha in his office, flesh-eating piranha. I walked in one day and he's feeding the piranha. I don't blame the piranha. Let's evaluate. The piranha didn't eat that goldfish in the way that it should have. Oregon, it was mission accomplished. If they flew across the country, they could have looked underwhelming. They could have had a hangover after losing to Indiana. I look at the way they handled business against Rutgers, and I go, okay, that gives me some confidence that this team can get back on track. Oregon will be judged, not on the loss to Indiana. You know, Ohio State came to Autzen Stadium last year. It was the one-year anniversary. It was the same weekend that Oregon beat Ohio State a year ago that Oregon lost to Indiana. It was the same college football weekend. One year later, nobody at the end of last season was looking back to Oregon beating Ohio State and going, Oregon's the better team. Nobody said that at the Rose Bowl. In fact, everybody's walking around shaking their heads going, man, that was a statement by Ohio State. Oregon has to do that. Let's go to James, who's in Eugene. James, welcome to the show.
Nobody.
Hey, John, how's it going?
Yeah, you're on, man. Go ahead.
Hey, did he just say that Rutgers was an Ivy League school?
Well, he said they were trying to be an Ivy League school. They're basically an Ivy League school is what he's saying. He's basically saying they're not good at football and they're not focused on football.
Okay, well, I watch a lot of players out there that I think were probably pretty focused on football. And to say that any of them are trying to go and play at a major college and have no idea or no care about going to the NFL, I think is kind of silly. I mean,
yeah,
I'm assuming there's several players on that team. I saw some pretty good athletes and stuff. I mean, the team's not great, but to say that no one on that team cares about going to the NFL.
There are NFL players on that roster. There are guys
there
who
are.
Play
there's
in the,
NFL talent. And even if they're not, I mean, close enough to where they think they are. So even if it doesn't work out in the long run for them as an individual, there's players all over that roster that think at some point in time or hope they're going to be an NFL player. So they're not going to Rutgers for the education. So let's all stop being silly that players that are playing D1 college football.
Student athletes
are focused more on the student side than the athlete side, because that is super silly. All right. Thanks, Sean.
Appreciate that. Drake Schiano, the coach at Rutgers, 6 days ago, in the lead-up to the Oregon game, pulled a little bit of a Mike Gundy. He started talking about the NIL collective at Rutgers. Rutgers does not have a single large NIL fund. So Schiano was complaining in the news conference in the run-up to the Oregon game. I don't know why it didn't get as much run as Gundy's comments. But he was saying, you're looking at the NIL collective, that basically all the money that comes into it, he is raising himself. He is not wrong that Division Street is a powerful force to be up against. Oregon's not just sharing $20.5 million of revenue with their athletes. They have Division Street. And so Oregon can spend as much as anybody. They can match anybody in college football. Rutgers can't. That's the stronger argument. If you're going to call in and say, hey, this was not a matchup, Dan Lanning could win this game in his sleep, that's the stronger argument that, you know, look, Oregon can spend, Rutgers can't. But I don't believe for a second that Dan Lanning didn't have a game plan. They had a game plan. They executed it brilliantly. I thought Kenyon Sadiq was fantastic, as good as I've seen him. You know, he's making plays out there. Clearly, you could see the NFL talent at Oregon that really stood out. But Oregon did what it should do. A lion does what it should do to a lamb. Chad's in Portland. Chad, welcome.
Hey, what's up, John? Love your show. Listen every chance I get, man. Hey, I wondered if you noticed this or if anyone else noticed this in the IU-Oregon game, but to me what stood out was, okay, Dan Lanning is, I'm going to go for it on fourth down on my own 30-yard line, and I've always thought that's bananas. But I noticed Kurt Cignetti really didn't get IU in those situations. And I wondered, man, I wish Dan Lanning was more focused on getting Oregon to third and manageable and stop thinking, hey, we've always got four downs to get this. I just was impressed with IU and how they moved the ball and didn't end up in fourth down situations. And I'll take offline, man. Thanks, John. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. Look, if the end game is to win playoff games, I saw some things on Saturday that got Oregon back on track. Meanwhile, nobody's talking about Oregon State. Nobody wants to talk about 1-7. Steven, I did not blame the Oregon State fans who jumped the railing at Reser Stadium and wanted to go celebrate, right? Look, go do it. Celebrate the little victories in life. I always say that. Your kid gets a nice report card, go celebrate it. You are out there in the world and wanting to have the success that comes with winning at a major level in major college football. You got to do some little things right. In Oregon State in the second half against Lafayette, little old Lafayette, did some things right and imposed its will. And I saw a team that I wasn't sure knew how to win games close out a game. And I think that's positive for Oregon State. Now, how many more wins are on this schedule for the Beavers? They've got Washington State coming up. I don't know. Washington State looked really good, but not very deep in a loss to Virginia. They should have beat Virginia, a ranked team.
They maybe should have beaten Ole Miss and Virginia on the road.
I think Washington State is better than Oregon State, right, in a number of ways. I like the quarterback, Zevi Eckhaus. Is it Zevi or Zevi? Eckhaus. Their quarterback, really good player. He's got a little moxie to him. Threw some interceptions, but I like how he plays.
How is he not starting at the start of the year, by the way?
Yeah, that's a Jimmy Rogers question.
Yeah,
I don't understand that.
I would love for you to get him on the show and just ask him that question for me, will you?
Like, how did you arrive? Because he wanted to foster this big competition in camp, and he was like, we don't have a starter. We have three guys.
Right.
We're going to let them battle it out, and which tells me you don't have a starter if you say you have three guys. But Eckhaus looks like the best player. And then they're just not very deep, particularly on the offensive line. But I just think the way they're playing, they've gone on the road to Ole Miss, and they played well. Probably their most impressive performance comes in a loss at Ole Miss. Then they follow that up for the second week in a row on the road. They go to Virginia. I don't even know if they came home after Mississippi. They might have just stayed out there. And they go to Virginia, and they probably should have won that game. They had a weird thing. They had, I don't know if you saw it, Steven. They called for a fair catch. A player who wasn't receiving the ball called for a fair catch. So when the guy took the kickoff return, he caught it at the 3-yard line. He was on the 3-yard line. That's where the ball had to start. And then their offensive line got shoved back into the end zone, and they give up a game losing safety. It was a gut wrenching result for Washington State, but I have, right now, if you tell me Washington State and Oregon State are playing, I would not pick those as wins for Oregon State right now. I got to see more from Oregon State to do that. But Oregon State showed me a little something against Lafayette. They're going to have to show me a big something in this game, these games against Washington State. They're going to have to be so much better. Now, can they beat Tulsa? Can they win against Sam Houston at home? Those are questions.
I mean, sure, they can.
You don't trust them.
No, I still don't, even after the win. I will say the second half was really good. They stepped on Lafayette's throat, and they really said, look, we're going to take advantage. We're going to be the more physical team. But, we kind of put the over-under at 3, last week going into the Lafayette game. I take the under still. I think they get one game. I cannot see them beating Washington State the way that they're playing at home or on the road. And then you're telling me they're going to have to go on the road and beat Tulsa? I don't know. I can't trust this team on the road yet. So I'd still take the under. I think 2-10 is the most likely finish for Oregon State this season.
You're going to, if they beat Washington State, because I keep thinking Washington State fans who keep asking me, Washington State's 3-4. And Washington State fans keep asking me, how many games are the Cougars going to win this season? And I am left kind of looking at that 3-4 record, and I'm going, okay, let's look at Washington State's remaining games. They have this weekend coming up. They have Toledo at home. I think they win that one. Then they go to Oregon State. Right now, the two games against Oregon State, I think conservatively you call it a split. I don't think that Washington State might win them both, but right now let's call it a split. So they beat Toledo. You give them a split against Washington State. Louisiana Tech goes to Washington State. That's a win for Washington State. And then Washington State goes to James Madison. So it's Toledo at home. It's La Tech at home. It's Oregon State at home. I'm going to go 3 wins there. Then it's at James Madison and at Oregon State. I say they split those. I think Washington State goes 4-1 to finish the season, and they end up with 7-5. How about you?
Yeah, I can see that. And 7-5, I mean, I think if you ask Washington State at the start of the year, they would take it. Yeah, especially after the first couple games when they barely beat Idaho. Remember week one, Idaho pushed them around. Washington State couldn't even run the football. They had, like, negative yards rushing. And now you look at them, and they're competing with Ole Miss, competing with Virginia. I think 7-5 would be an incredible season for Washington State, and I think that can happen. Because I think they're getting two wins against Oregon State for sure. I cannot see that. Toledo has talent, like, in the MAC, but they've been really disappointing this season. Louisiana Tech on the road or at home, I think they get that game. The James Madison one's going to be tough, but you do have to wonder, like, where's James Madison's head? Because they're going to be competing for a Sun Belt title. Like, now you got a non-conference game coming in. They, you know, they could win all five, but I think 4-1 is the most likely situation.
Washington, meanwhile, goes to Ann Arbor. I had crawled out on a limb and picked Washington in an upset against Michigan. And then I watched that game, and I'm just baffled because Washington, who entered the game number 8 in the country against the run, can't stop the run, and they can't run the football against Michigan. The physicality test, they failed it again against a Big Ten team. And Damon Williams Jr., I think, knew they couldn't run the ball. He's trying to do too much. He's pressing. He's throwing 3 interceptions. You're not going to beat Michigan throwing 3 interceptions. And it's just not a great showing for Jed Fish's team. It made me wonder, with all the coaching jobs that are open, if Florida comes calling for Jed Fish, I kind of think Jed Fish would take that call, Stephen. I think, you know, I'm not sure his family loves it in Seattle. I'm not sure he's ever going to be a Seattle guy. And I was discouraged for him because I thought, given the recruiting that they had and the messaging and maybe even the way they played against Ohio State, that they would be much better against Michigan. They were not. They got shoved around, and it was a very disappointing outcome. I still agree with Roy, the caller earlier. I think when Oregon goes to Washington later in the year, it could be dicey. It could be dicey.
I actually changed my mind. I thought it was going to be dicey. I don't think it is. I think Oregon's going to pound them with the way Washington's been kind of pushed around this season. Michigan got pushed around by USC. I thought Washington was going to be able to run the football and do some stuff. They scored 7 points on the road. Michigan, yeah. I don't think Michigan's that good. I think Oregon kind of can go in there and gonna dominate that game. I think Washington's in trouble. I think they get the next 2. I think Wisconsin's horrible. Purdue isn't very good. But even down to UCLA, like, that's not a win. And then you're taking on Oregon. That's not a win. You take on Illinois. I think Illinois is going to shove it down their throat, too. Yeah. I think you're right. I think if Jed Fish can get opportunity, he's bouncing. He's out of there.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the Mariners Game 7. We've got it right here on 750 The Game. Mariners will be playing the Blue Jays, winner take all. Jason Puckett from Seattle will be joining us coming up later this hour to talk about his fan experience. He's been at some of these games. He's a media member there. What does this Game 7 mean to the Mariners? You'll hear Puck coming up. He'll be joining us about 4:35. Once you hear for it. We're going to play Punch It Audio after the break. Stick around.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
We'll be talking with Jason Puckett, PuckSports.com, coming up in a few minutes. Before that, let's play some Punch It Audio. Let's go, Stephen.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Paul Feinbaum, SEC honk, saying that it feels like the Saban era at Alabama. What does he mean?
They could. I mean, right now I'd probably still side with Ohio State. But Matt, having been down there Friday and Saturday, the vibe was off the charts. It's so different to feel. It's such a different feeling. I mean, it feels a little bit like the Saban era again, even though we know who is in charge. But Kalen DeBoer has just it's been a transformational project. And I think they are. Alabama is in the conversation for the best team in the country. I think we can all go there.
Wasn't that long ago? They were calling for his head. Florida State 31, Alabama 17. Do you remember that? Since then, it's been easy pickings for Alabama and some validation against Georgia, Vanderbilt, Missouri, Tennessee. He's on a run. He's on a roll. How good is the SEC? I don't know. Steven, how good is the SEC?
I think it's the best conference in America. I think they are getting a little overhyped with teams like Missouri. I think Vanderbilt's real, but I think Alabama's beaten some really good teams. And I disagree with Feinbaum that it's this Nick Saban type feel, but I do think Bama top five team for sure. And you could be pushing towards one with Ty Simpson there. They look good, and DeBoer's got the thing rolling.
I need to see crossover games. When you lose to Florida State, Florida State's not good. I wonder still. Dante Moore at Oregon saying that the Indiana loss helped them this week.
Yeah, I think it starts with the head man. He texted me after the game. Just understanding that, you know, when you have a tough week and take it as, you know, take a loss, you just take it as a lesson. And I feel like when we attacked that Monday, he just had, you know, that confidence and trust in me still. And as a player, you love that when your head coach has full 100% confidence and trust in you. So I feel like overall, as a whole team, he has trust in the whole team. And we attacked this week, understanding that, you know, it was a tough loss, but Indiana's a great team. But make sure this week we just learn from our mistakes, push through the week Monday through Friday. And I feel like the whole week we did a great job, offense and defense, tight end, special teams. So we did a great job. Make sure to understand that, you know, we take that loss as a lesson and we push through this week. And I feel like we did a great job today.
We've got to recalibrate. It used to be that a loss would ruin your college football season. You have a mulligan. In fact, you have two mulligans if you're in a power conference. Oregon is in a good position. Schedule's favorable. It's Wisconsin. I do look at the games at Iowa, home against USC, and at Washington, and I go, okay, you can drop one in there. You can't drop two. But Oregon, to me, looked like a team that had figured out, like, all right, let's get back, let's regroup. Can we say that this is a validating moment for Oregon? No. But it was like, okay, they did what they should do to that team. Meanwhile, Jabari Johnson, quarterback Oregon State, was asked if he should be the starting quarterback.
It's whatever they want to go with it, but I feel like I'm just going to do my job when I get in there. I can't make them make me the starter or anything, but I'm going to just be able to do my job when I go in.
I find it interesting that, you know, you can tell that there may be a division in this team with guys who prefer Malik Murphy and guys who prefer Jabari Johnson. For him to openly say, like, you know, he's not saying, you know, that guy's really good, I'm happy to accept my role. He's not saying that. He's saying, I want to be the starter, but it's up to them. I do expect Jabari Johnson's going to be the guy moving forward. Anybody who saw the second half against Lafayette has to know. And I think the body language of Malik Murphy was bad, bad, bad. Now, I would say to Malik Murphy, you're getting $1.5 million. Go figure this out. Go act like you want to matter. Go play like you want to matter. Otherwise, you are going to become the guy that was like, wow, they wasted $1.5 million on him. Greg McElroy says the top of the Big Ten is elite.
The top tier of the Big Ten have clearly pulled away. All right. This is very obvious. We know who the top three teams are right now in the Big Ten. The Ohio State Buckeyes, the Indiana Hoosiers, then the Oregon Ducks. That's the order, right? We knew there was a gap between the top three and everybody else. And even if you want to go as far, I know Indiana fans, we need to give you your flowers. Really, the top two, there's a gap. Well, I don't think the gap between two and three is that significant, but it does feel like the gap between three and four is enormous. Highly impressed with what I've seen from those three teams throughout the start of the season. And it feels like, as crazy as this may sound, their best football might be in front of them.
I think Ohio State is alone at the top. I think after that, it's Indiana, it's Oregon. And I'm going to throw a wrinkle in here. The way that UCLA has been playing, the way that Iowa plays at home, the win for Michigan over USC, it gave me a little bit of pause because I started to think, like, what happens if it gets a little messy here with that second team getting to the Big Ten championship? And I have to point this out, Stephen. UCLA, I'm not predicting this is going to happen, but if UCLA wins out, UCLA plays at Indiana this week.
It's a big one.
UCLA plays at Ohio State on November 15th. If UCLA wins out, UCLA's in the Big Ten championship game.
I mean, they're not.
Just wrap your head around that.
They're not going to win out, but I will.
They're not.
I will say, I kind of like them this week against Indiana. Keep that thing rolling. I'm all aboard, man. That offense is. It wasn't great last week, but that's a different team now, and they got some dudes over there. I'm kind of on them this week.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about the Mariners and Blue Jays Game 7. John Smoltz says, here's what's at stake tonight.
Yeah, I know this, again, seems like a simple statement, but when I look at this series and I see the star power on both teams, you can look directly to the wins correlated to the stars. And it does come down to that. Now, you know, fair or not, Julio Rodriguez has been moved up to the number one spot because they've had to change their lineup. And I just look for the first two hitters to make the impact tonight.
There it is. The big hitters, the first hitters in the lineup. It's Cal Raleigh. It's Julio Rodriguez. It's Eugenio Suarez. That's what it comes down to for the Mariners. We'll talk to Jason Puck at PuckSports.com about that coming up. Puck is not just a media member in Seattle. He is a fan. He'll be joining us to capture the flavor of what is going on. What does it feel like to be around this team? Steven, you got a pick for the Game 7? Get on record now. Who do you like?
Give me the Mariners just for fun. Let's do it.
I'm with you. I like the Mariners. Then it sets up a West Coast World Series Mariners-Dodgers. So I like that. Shohei Ohtani. Gosh, can you think? Imagine that. Imagine Dodgers-Mariners for all the marbles. But we shall see. Jason Puckett will be talking about it coming up. He will lead us right into the broadcast of Game 7 here on 750 The Game. Stick around. You got the BFT.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Our next guest has lived it and loved it. He's been a Mariners fan all his life. Jason Puckett, PuckSports.com. That's where you can find him. He hosts a daily show there. It's an interactive show that streams live. Jason Puckett, lifetime Mariners fan, joining us. And it has to be a little nervous. We're talking about a Game 7. And weird things can happen in a Game 7. But if you're a Mariners fan, you have to be feeling pretty good about this matchup tonight. A chance to win a game and go to the World Series. Jason Puckett joining us. Take us through. I mean, you've been at these games. You know what it's like. You have lived it. I don't know if you ever thought you would be one game away from a World Series, but here you are as a Mariners fan. You're one game away from a World Series. How does that feel?
Yeah, if you told me when I was like 10, you know, sitting in the King Dome with like 3,000 other people, and I never thought this team would be in this position where they're at. I mean, you know, I think the closest when you think back is, you know, 95 was amazing, and you know, the 97 team probably doesn't get enough credit for how really good it was offensively. 2001, it seemed destined, and then it just, you know, it was such an historic regular season, and then it fell apart there in the playoffs, you know, in the championship series against the Yankees, who were just like, it felt like because of the circumstances and everything that was surrounding it was destined to get there. This is it. I mean, right? 48 years of people that have been, you know, this franchise has been in existence, and here it is. It's, you know, it's one step closer to being, you know, erasing the trivia question that everybody in this city and this state and this region is tired of answering, as they're the only team never to appear in the World Series. So I think there's a lot of excitement. I know I'm excited. I think this is what sports is all about. I know a lot of people are nervous and scared and like biting their fingernails to get to 5 o'clock. I'm the opposite. I'm excited to get to 5 o'clock. I'm excited to see these players who have a chance to be the first, right? And I think anytime you're the first in anything, you are in the special, like, Hall of Fame fandom category. And so if they're able to get it done tonight, guys like Cal and Julio and JP and the rest of them will be in a special wing amongst themselves that used to just be reserved for the 95 team and the 01 team. The 25 team would certainly jump them.
Let's help us understand the Mariners in that market, because my understanding is that, you know, they don't get the profile of the Seahawks. They don't, you know, they haven't, you know, there isn't quite the buzz about them. Where do they fit in that market, and what could winning a Game 7 do to change that?
Well, I think it's always been a sleeping giant, right? And because, you know, I think the baseball team is different than, well, similar to the NFL team, and I guess similar to the other teams, not so much when we had the NBA, but those teams are regional teams, right? Because there's nothing else in the surrounding states that have a baseball team. So, you know, it's, I worked in Portland, right? So, I mean, the numbers when I was there were huge of people that watched Mariners games, and your listeners, there's probably a lot of Mariner fans. And so there's parts of Oregon, you know, Idaho and Alaska and Montana. So it's more of a regionalized a team. I mean, the Seahawks certainly compare to it, to a degree, because there's not, you know, neighboring states is not an NFL team to them. And I just think that it's been, you know, since you were born and raised a Mariners fan, it's been beaten down in you that they're going to lose and disappoint you every single year. That you get your hopes up, you can't wait for spring training is here, and then the season starts and they go 5-20. Or there's this, they're on the cover of Sports Illustrated, it's Robinson Cano and Nelson Cruz and Felix Hernandez, and then they lose 100 games. You're just conditioned as a fan of this baseball team to expect the very worst to happen. And so it's to have the opportunity for them to be this close to it, 27 outs away. And I think it's, I think a lot of people have dreamed of this. There's parents, there's people's grandparents who like all they want before they say goodbye and go up, you know, go up north is to see this team play, you know, in the World Series. And I think that's, I think there's a nervous energy in the city right now, in anticipation for it. And there's part of me that's like, okay, and I have to fight this because I hate this part of me as a fan. It's like, what's going to go wrong tonight? Because I mean, in my mind, I'm just, there's, what is going to go wrong tonight and why are we going to lose? And it's an awful way to be a fan. And it certainly infiltrates me a lot.
Who do you worry about in a game seven, and who don't you worry about? Who do you know, okay, that guy's good, when you think about this lineup and the pitching staff?
Well, I don't worry about George Kirby tonight. And I know that sounds strange because the last time that he pitched, he, you know, was not good and they roughed him up pretty hard. But he is, you know, we all come across athletes like this. And I said this about Bryce Miller, and this was before the series started, that I just had a feeling about Bryce Miller because of how he carries himself, how he doesn't get too high, doesn't get too low. Maybe it's the Texan in him. Because he just, you know, that's that attitude that I think Texans have that is different than maybe a lot of other people. I just felt really good about how he was going to perform the series, and he's been the best pitcher they've had. I have a similar feeling about George Kirby like that. He is, his nickname is Furious George. He has this very quiet, burning desire to win. You know, he's that type of guy. I know a lot of athletes are like this. They hate losing more than they like winning. And when he is on and has that mentality of a big game pitcher, which he has been in these big spots before, you know, especially 3 years ago when they were in the postseason for the first time in 25 years, he won the clinching game in Toronto when they came back to win that one. And he was sensational in the 18-inning game against Houston. I think he carries that on the mound tonight. He doesn't have to give them 6 innings. He can give them 3, maybe 4, and he's done his job. And I think when you have that mentality going into it, you know, I think that that helps you on the mound. I think I'm not worried about Julio. I think Julio plays the game and carries himself. And I know sometimes he gets criticized for this, but this 12-year-old joyful exuberance about him as if he's playing Little League and can't wait to go to Dairy Queen after the game.
Love that.
But I think it helps him. I think it helps him in moments like this, because he had a press conference today and he's all smiles and like, he's like, I can't wait to play tonight. Because this is it, game seven, right? The two best words in sports, game seven. And I think that helps you with an approach. I think some players are going to get tight tonight, and you'll see it. Is even though they're professionals, right, and they've paid lots of money and they've been doing this their whole lives, they feel the nerves. I don't feel nervous about him. And then I think for Cal Raleigh, Cal has been a steady heartbeat of this baseball team and leader, and he never allows himself to get too high, too low. Those guys don't worry me. The guy who worries me the most is Matt Brash, who's the reliever. He scares the life out of me because I don't know. Anytime he comes into the game, John, I don't know. Cal Raleigh doesn't know. No one on the staff knows where that ball is going. So he worries me, you know, from a personal standpoint. But I think these guys have always responded this year
when their backs have been up against the wall or they haven't performed or coming off a losing streak or what have you. I think they'll respond tonight. I think it's going to be a tight game. It's, you know, if it goes nine, I think it has a chance to go more than nine.
Right.
Just because that's how it feels. That's how this whole season has felt.
They showed a video of the Blue Jays dugout, and I saw, you know, Max Scherzer over there with his two eyes. That's freaky. We got to talk about that another time. But he's over there in the dugout, and you could see, like, he's a guy that kind of scares me on the other side, because if this goes, like, it's a 15-inning game, I kind of think they bring that guy in to give him, like, three quality innings somewhere late in the game, and you know, he has that Jack Morris feel to him, and you know, so it's going to be fun to see this. 162 in the regular season, 5 in the ALDS, now 6 more in the ALCS. We're at what, game 174. Tell us what Seattle and what, you know, what did it feel like today to do your show? And again, we're talking to Jason Puckett, PuckSports.com. You're going to do a whole Mariners show tomorrow, win or lose, on your show, and it's fantastic. Check that out. It streams live. You can watch it live. You can watch it on YouTube. But give us an idea of what it feels like, you know, to go to the grocery store or the gas station amid all this.
I think it's one of those things where you just see everyone, you know, they're walking around, and it's that, whether they're wearing Mariners gear or not, but it's that you look at someone and they catch you, some stranger looking at them for a quick second, and it's like this little, like, wink and nod, like, you know what's online, what's at stake tonight. And you know, it's, you know, in this town, in majority of towns, you know, across, you know, the U.S., you know, NFL dominates, and the Seahawks play tonight. They play at 7 o'clock tonight. I mean, I there's people calling me left and right. I'm hearing from friends trying to unload tickets. Do you know anybody wants to go? I mean, this might. I mean, the Seahawks game. I don't even know if anyone's going to be at the stadium to watch it. And even if they're there, the game starts at 7. You've got a baseball game that's starting at 5, and it's like you're going to be in, like, the heart of, like, the real nail-biting moments of the game. And so how many people are going to be focused on that and not in their seats but in the concourse watching? But I think it's, you know, what makes baseball different than football. Basketball has this. Hockey's got this. The long series, it's every day. Something new is happening. Something different's happening. And you know, nobody, no fan base romanticizes more about their sport than baseball fans. And you know this. I mean, you grew up with it, played it, you know, in college. You know what it's about. And so it's with you every single day. You pass it down to your kids, and you hope they love the game as much as you do. My kids do. They're obsessed with it. They love it. And so to watch that, and for them to, you know, for their ages not to go through all the heartbreak and just the disgust and the angst that I have, you know, over my lifetime, to have them be able to sit with them tonight and clinch something that has never been done, is going to be pretty special. And you walk around, there's probably a lot of parents and people that are walking around and grocery stores and all that thinking the same thing tonight, that you don't get these opportunities that often. And this is why I love sports. I love the competition. I love who steps up. Because there's going to be somebody that you didn't think is going to make a play tonight, that you had no idea that they could make, and they're going to make it tonight because, you know, the game's on the line, and heroes in all different forms step up big in these games.
All right, so you've been to some games. You've been to quite a few games this season. I kind of follow you on social media. I see the spot you sit in the stadium. Now, you got to go to some of the ALDS or ALCS games. What's the difference in price for a ticket to see a regular season game or go to one of these playoff games?
So we don't have like season tickets or anything, but we just always sit in the bleachers. So center field or left field bleacher seats, right? You know, right where all the flags are. It's where Cal Raleigh's home run went the other day to tie the game. So generally in the season, those tickets are about $10 to $20 per seat. Let's see, the last game 5, they were $165. And, you know, even earlier in the series, there were $300. So, I mean, it's just a massive jump. I mean, like, they go to the World Series, you know, we're the first game at home. I'm assuming those are going to be, you know, $300-$500 or whatever, somewhere in there. You know, for a seat that's $10, you're sitting on a bleacher, John. I mean, it's not even your own seat, for God's sakes. But, you know, it's this, you know, the difference in prices is expected. I wish maybe the teams would lower them down a little bit so the fans who've been going all year long can still go. But, you know, if they make the World Series, I mean, God, I don't, my kids don't need another $17 Starbucks drink, so I think we can go to the Mariners game.
There you go. Jason Puck at PuckSports.com. You got big plans for tomorrow's show. People can stream the show live on Twitter. That's where I've seen it. You can see it, catch it on YouTube. Puck, how else do they find you?
Yeah, you got it. The live show air on Twitter, YouTube. If you want to listen to it live, there's an app, just Puck Sports mobile app for your iPhone and Android phones. And then once the show is over, everything is podcast like everything is nowadays. So it's up on YouTube. Search Puck Sports. You can just also Puck Sports on Apple and Spotify and all your favorite podcast platforms.
Are you superstitious? Will you sit in a certain spot tonight, or how are you going to take the game in?
Yeah, certain spot, same shirt. Things don't go well. Get up, pace around the house, do a couple things. Try not to yell at the dogs. My dogs get real sensitive during these games. They don't like the yelling and the screaming. And then if I have to find myself, you know, in a closet by myself and put on the radio, I'll do that. Because if I get nervous, sometimes I can't watch, and I like listening to baseball on the radio.
The MVP, if the Mariners win it, who's your MVP? Who's your pick to be the MVP? For the degenerate gamblers.
You always kind of, you side with offensive players, right, for MVPs. But if he's going to appear in this game tonight at some point, I bet, because I think there's all hands on deck for the Mariners pitching staff. I think it's going to be a close game, a 3-2 ball game, something like that. And I think you'll see Bryce Miller again. And I think Bryce Miller, if he comes in and pitches another, inning or two, and has been fantastic. For me, he has been the best player in this series, for sure. Without a doubt for the Mariners side.
Jason Puckett, you're the best, man. Good luck to you, and hopefully we will see you cheering at a World Series game.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Go M's.
There he goes. Jason Puckett, PuckSports.com. Mariners fans, how you feeling? We're going to lead you right into the Game 7 right here on 750 The Game. It'll be coming up top of the hour. Mariners Blue Jays for all the marbles. I'm hoping for a World Series, of course. Like, I would always root for the Pacific Northwest, and I would love to see the Mariners against the Dodgers. Forget all this Shohei Ohtani. It'd be the biggest underdog story in baseball. You have this team that has a payroll in the middle of the pack against the Dodgers, who have the number two payroll in baseball, and it's only because they've figured out a loophole to circumvent the salary cap situation and pay Shohei Ohtani all this deferred compensation. You better believe the rest of the owners in Major League Baseball are going to do something about the Dodgers. They're going to take a look at what the Dodgers are doing, at least make them pay the tax if they're going to spend that way. But coming up, we've got Mariners Blue Jays. You've got the bald-faced truth statewide. Leave it right here.